On RN Summer, Lynn Malcolm with you for All in the Mind. And today, how strong are you when faced with a little temptation?
Over the years, psychology has really just found two traits that enable people to be better off in all manner of walks of life, and these are intelligence and self-control. And we've been trying for decades to produce lasting improvements in intelligence, and it's really hard to do. But self-control, we really can improve that. And so, to me, part of the excitement is this is one way in which psychological research can help make people better and really provide an important key to the good life.
Willpower is the greatest and most coveted human strength, according to Professor of Psychology Roy Baumeister. He's conducted pioneering research about our capacity for self-control. And as we'll hear later, he says that it's possible to improve our self-control and strengthen our willpower, giving us the potential to redirect our lives. Willpower is thought to be controlled by the front of our brain, the prefrontal cortex, which is the last part of the human brain to evolve. Roy Baumeister also speaks about it as an energy.
Willpower would be the energy that is used for self-control, that if you want to put it in brain terms, exerting control to alter one's responses, to change your feelings, to control your thoughts, to control your behaviors, resist temptations, and even to perform well. But those are not easy. It takes energy to overcome an impulse or a response. And so willpower seems to be that energy.
It sounds a little bit Victorian.
Yes. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and there was such a rebellion against those Victorian ideas and so on. I thought they were ridiculous. And yet then, here a couple decades later, I'm finding out, well, the Victorians actually did know something. They talked about building character. We thought this was a quaint, absurd notion. But yes, in our laboratory studies, that's exactly what happens when people exercise their self-control. They become better at it, even on things very different from what they exercised. So it's not as moralistic or religious as a context as I think the Victorians understood it, but the underlying psychology that they had seems to be quite valid. So I've rediscovered some respect for the Victorians.
The question of whether we have free will, which is related to this, is also a philosophical question, isn't it? How does your research fit into that philosophical question of free will?
Oh, well, that's been a very enjoyable and unexpected aspect. With self-control, I hadn't really thought about free will or those terms. But then we discovered that willpower, the same energy that you use for self-control, is also depleted when you make decisions. So making choices and self-control have this common psychological and it looks like even physiological substrate. And the philosophers would not know that. And I realize their writings about free will used examples of self-control and examples of making decisions, but they had no way of knowing that those share some important common practices, which we were able to find in research in psychology. So philosophers have been very interested in this. I'm collaborating with a couple of philosophers. I appreciated their insights.
Roy Baumeister says that poor self-control correlates with just about every kind of individual trauma that we experience. People with weak willpower don't do well at school, they're less popular, they make less money, have more traffic accidents, and they're more likely to be arrested.
A book came out 20 years ago or so called A General Theory of Crime, and it was by a couple criminologists. Their conclusion was it was about low self-control. That's just a screwing up lifestyle where you don't follow the rules. People with low self-control express more prejudice. They have more problems with emotional control, anger, anxiety, things like that. Even the physicians have been telling us for years that we'd all live longer if we just eat better, exercise regularly, and stop smoking, and yet people don't do those. Again, all of those require self-control. So as I said, it becomes hard to find some problems that don't involve self-control.
So let's just get an idea of some of the research that you've done to really understand this concept of willpower being a finite energy.
Okay, well, the idea is that when you use self-control, it looks like it uses up some energy. How could we test this in the lab? And I thought, well, if we have them engage in one task of self-control, that should deplete some of the energy. And then afterwards, if we gave them a different self-control task, So it's not doing the same thing. It's just doing something else, but it would make similar demands. They presumably should do worse on it. So we would run these studies where we'd have them do one task and then a different self-control task. The first one, we measured the strength of their hands. Then we had them watch a movie, and some of them we told, it was kind of an upsetting movie, and some we told, well, we want you to stifle your emotional reactions, don't show any feelings, and try not to have any reactions. Others were supposed to increase their emotions and change and try to react as strongly as you can. And the third group, just let your emotions go however they go, so they don't have to exert self-control. And then we measured their stamina, how long could they squeeze a hand grip. It turned out that the control group did about the same before and after the exercise, the ones who didn't control their emotions, but both the ones who tried to increase and the ones who tried to decrease their emotions, either direction of emotion control, that used up something, apparently, and so their hand grip, on average, were significantly worse. They gave up faster on the next test. So that's one sort of study. And we've done lots of other studies. We had people resist the temptation to eat chocolate, you know, just having to sit there 5 minutes, and we made them eat radishes instead of
that's cruel.
of the chocolates and pastries. And so they just had to resist the temptation to eat something sweet and delicious. And then we measured how long they would persevere and keep trying on a frustrating task. And they gave up a lot faster. Again, resisting temptation took something out of them that they needed to persevere on the second task. So a couple hundred published papers, but this two-task thing, it replicates over and over. The first task seems to use up some energy, and the second task, then they don't have enough willpower to help them do as well as they otherwise would.
So what do we know about how much desire we have and how much desire we're resisting in our everyday lives?
Well, that is an excellent question. And it turns out psychology did not really have much of an answer for it. A couple of colleagues and I decided, well, we've got to try to find this out. So we set up a study to have people carry beepers around as they went about their daily lives and activities. And every so often the beeper would go off and we'd have them report, are you desiring anything right now? And if so, what? And so on. And we find people reported that they were having a desire about half the time. So that's about 8 hours a day of experiencing desires. Now, there may be small desires, like a desire to have a cup of tea or go to the bathroom or eat something, as much as a desire to save the world or fall in love or have sex with somebody. But desires, great and small, we have them about half the time we're awake, and about 2 out of 5 of those, about 40%, people try to restrict or control. So there's a lot of use of self-control to restrain your desires.
And so we're actually using a lot of energy all the time to resist desire.
Yes, yes. And so, yes, that does take energy. And as you do that over the day, you get worn down. We found people become more likely to give in to a temptation as the day wears on and their willpower starts to get depleted.
So what are the implications from this about how we should manage our willpower energy, I guess?
Well, it's important to understand how it works, and that it is limited and that other things take demand on it and that it will get depleted, making you vulnerable to making bad choices, making impulsive decisions, letting people talk you into things, making mistakes, especially indulging things that you'll be sorry about later. Unfortunately, there's no feeling. You can't really tell when you're depleted.
I'm in love. I'm having a relationship with my pizza.
I can't.
I mean, you can't. This is pizza margarita in Napoli. It is your moral imperative to eat and enjoy that pizza.
I want to, but I've gained like 10 pounds. I mean, I've got this right here in my tummy. You know, this, what's it called? What's the word for it?
A muffin top. I have one too. I'm so tired of waking up in the morning and recalling every single thing I ate the day before. Counting every calorie I consume so I know exactly how much self-loathing to take into the shower. I'm going for it. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to finish this pizza. And tomorrow, we're going to go on a little date and buy ourselves some bigger jeans.
So let's take one of the classic situations where willpower is required, and that's with dieting. How does this play into how difficult it is to diet?
Diet is an especially difficult case because it turns out the energy for willpower is linked to your body's basic energy supply. So That's kind of a catch-22, that in order to resist the temptation to eat, you need willpower. In order to have willpower, you need to eat.
For energy.
For the energy, as it is the energy that comes in with food that fuels the willpower. Large-scale studies, a meta-analysis which takes the results of lots of different scientific studies and combines them statistically. There was one a couple of years ago. And yes, people with good self-control are better than ones with bad self-control at dieting. That's probably not a surprise. The surprise is more how weak that effect was. There's so many other things with dieting, partly your genes and the natural tendency of the body to conserve its energy. You really should conserve your diets too, because the more often you diet, the more your body learns to fight the diet, because the first diet often can work pretty well. That's even shown with controlled studies with rats and so on, where the researchers will give them all the food they want to eat and kind of fatten them up and then put them on a restricted diet and put them back on a regular diet and then restrict again. And the first time they fatten up nicely, then the first time the food is restricted, they lose weight, and then they get more food and they fatten up again faster, even the second time. And then they put them back on the restricted diet and it's much slower. And then by the third time, they may not lose at all. So self-control, where it has big effects on performance in school and in work, it's a small effect on eating and dieting because of all these other things that complicate it. Given the importance of willpower, one bit of advice is don't try to diet by just not eating. Instead, try to fill yourself up with healthy food first. So then your body will have the energy to fuel the willpower. Then make the decision about, are you going to have a bite of the cake or not?
There's also the area of addiction, because if you're addicted to something, there's a physical pull going on to interfere with your willpower. How does this fit into when you're hooked on an addictive substance, for example?
Yes, I'm reading the addiction literature now, and it's fascinating. There are a few studies that measure when people are quitting. Do they relapse when they are having a particularly strong craving? What seems to happen is that the craving strength fluctuates, goes up and down, but that doesn't predict the relapse. It's your own willpower, if you will, your ability to resist. When that is low, that's when you fail and start to relapse. The addiction itself does not seem to compromise your control, but trying to resist it places another demand on it. There was just a study that came out that I think showed that dieters do worse at quitting smoking than non-dieters. Well, you're dieting, you're putting some of your willpower into controlling your food intake, and that takes away what you have to resist the cigarette temptation. So doing two things at once divides up your energies, and you don't have as much to go around. We had some research into women's premenstrual syndrome, which looks like at the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle, the female body needs a lot more of the glucose, the basic energy behind willpower, for the reproductive activities. Some women do eat more at that stage, but they don't usually eat enough more to compensate for the energy that's being pulled off for that. So what it looks like happens is that the bad effects of premenstrual syndrome are because the self-control is impaired, and that includes there's much more use of substances and addictive relapse at that phase than at the other points, because the body is taking away. And if you understand these things, you can plan for them and probably cope with them well. But if it just hits you, you think, well, what's different today than any other day? But I really want a cigarette today, or cocaine, or whatever happens to be their addiction. It isn't that women take up new addictions or new substances at this stage. Rather, whatever their favorite thing is, they're more likely to indulge in that.
Our levels of willpower fluctuate through the day, and it also feeds into our ability to make decisions. What happens when you're in a position where the decisions you make have major implications for your or someone else's life? Like a judge in a court of law, for example.
Yes, well, you'll have a lot more willpower in the morning than at the end of the day. There's a terrific study a couple of my colleagues and friends did on decisions by parole judges in Israel. There, the easy thing is just to send the guy back to jail. The risk for the judge is if you give someone parole, he goes out and commits another crime, then it makes the judge look bad. Well, you know, they just come up in random order as the day wears on. But when my colleagues tracked them, the ones who came up first thing in the morning had a pretty good chance of getting parole. And by the end of the afternoon, hardly anybody had a chance of getting parole. It was just a steady downward thing across the day, with two exceptions. at middle of the morning, the judges got a break and would get a snack, a piece of fruit and a sandwich or something. And then lunch was the second break. But both of those, they get in more food, which gives them more fuel for glucose. So the likelihood of giving parole went way up again right after both of those breaks. Tell people when they speak as if you ever find yourself in that position and you're asking for parole and they say, oh, we can get one more of you in before lunch. Say, no, thank you. I'll wait till after lunch.
Feed them a big cream cake.
the judge will be in a much... So if you're the judge, executive or politician or whatever, you probably want to be sure to make your decisions when you have the most willpower, which there's no way of feeling it. You just have to know these things. That's going to be after a good night's sleep and a healthy breakfast, and it'll be somewhat improved after lunch. If you're making a big decision about the future of your company or your marriage or whatever late on Friday afternoon, it may not be as good a decision as you would make on the first thing Tuesday morning after a good night's sleep.
Temptation.
You're with All in the Mind on RN Summer, online, Radio Australia, and on your ABC mobile app. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, we're exploring our strength of will. But how much is known about what determines who has good self-control and who doesn't? Well, it's certainly a combination of nature and nurture, and it looks like differences emerge early in life. Shortly we'll hear about how most of us can actually improve and strengthen our self-control. But what about the genetic component? Tom Denson, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of New South Wales, was stimulated by the work of Roy Baumeister to look at human beings' capacity for self-control when it comes to anger.
Our work is all about anger and aggression, not necessarily the cold, calculated type of aggression, but really when people are provoked and they get upset and they can't control themselves, which is much more common than that former type of aggression. So what we're looking at is emotion regulation, in particular anger regulation, as relying on this limited resource. And that's what we've found. When you're depleted, you become more aggressive. And conversely, when we get people to either practice self-control or we give them a little boost in self-control by giving them a glucose beverage relative to a placebo, we see that aggressive people are no longer aggressive.
Right. So you found that in relation to aggression, but there is also a strong genetic component of aggression, isn't there? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so aggression is one of those traits that is among the most heritable. And having said that, it's about 50% heritable. So there's the other 50% is obviously environmental. The reason being is it was adaptive in our ancestral past. And there's been some studies done back in the 60s and 70s where they looked at hunter-gatherer societies. And they found that in some of these ultra-violent hunter-gatherer societies, the men who had committed homicide actually had more offspring. It's very hard to imagine now in today's world where we have police and law enforcement and so on. But back in the old days, people really did have to defend themselves with violence. We still have that with us today. We have obviously haven't evolved to be nonviolent yet. But cultural evolution is a much more powerful force in today's world than actual, you know, physical evolution. And what we're seeing is that people are becoming nicer and people are trying to regulate their anger. And that's what we see in our experiments when we give people, aggressive people in particular. Now, these are people who report, you know, getting into fights more often than the average person. When we actually give them the ability to control themselves, they do take it.
So let's talk specifically about the gene that's the strongest connection to aggression.
So the gene we looked at is called monoamine oxidase A. It's MAOA for short. Some people talk about it in the media in terms of being called a warrior gene. But what it is about 35% of the male population have sort of the low-functioning version of this gene. And if you do have that low-functioning version, you're at increased risk for becoming violent or aggressive. Not necessarily that all of those people are going to go on and commit violent acts. And in fact, there's, again, an environmental component. So if you have that gene and you also have an abusive upbringing, then you're especially likely to become a violent person.
So it's low functioning, that is, you have less control over.
What it codes for an enzyme that breaks down neurotransmitters in your brain. So if you don't have the properly functioning gene, you have sort of more inefficient emotion regulation. And that's what we've been finding in our neuroimaging research.
And what parts of the brain are involved and how does it regulate emotion?
So what we saw in this most recent neuroimaging study, what we did is we took about 40 men and we put them in the scanner and we provoked them, we insulted them while they were in there. At the end of the study, of course, we debriefed everyone and everyone sort of had a good laugh.
How did you provoke them?
I just pretty much pretended like I couldn't hear them and that they screwed up my experiment. I mean, that tends to make people mad because you're essentially treating these grown men like children. But we needed to get this real reaction out of people.
You needed that emotional reaction.
That's right, yeah, because we want to model what's happening in the real world. And what we found in that study is that the men that had this low-functioning version of the gene showed inefficient functioning in, we had two regions that we looked at. One of them is the amygdala, which many people have probably heard of, is being involved in emotional arousal, a real primitive region that we share with all mammals. And then we had another region, the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, which is involved in activating the prefrontal cortex and regulating emotions in a more conscious manner. And what we found is that the people with the low functioning allele had more activation in both of these regions. And in fact, those regions were very tightly connected. So whereas people that had the high functioning allele, they didn't show any change in activation in these regions when they were provoked or when they weren't. And in fact, they were better able to decouple so they could stop the amygdala from talking essentially to the more recently evolved region in the prefrontal cortex.
So could you tell anything about those people who had the lower functioning gene? If they try harder at controlling their aggression, are they likely to succeed?
They reported trying just as hard as everybody else. But in fact, what we saw is that inefficient functioning then predicted how hard they had tried. So they were just showing a lot more activation, trying just as hard, but their brains were working harder.
So the implication there is that those people with the lower functioning gene are really up against it. And some people, I suppose, just won't be able to have good self-control.
That's right. So that their brains, to accomplish the same level of anger control that people with the high-functioning gene have, these people with the low-functioning gene are actually showing more activations. As I said, their brains are working harder to achieve that same level of control. Yeah.
And if they've been exposed to a traumatic childhood, then they're even less likely to be able to control.
That's right, yeah. We didn't measure that in our study, but in several other large-scale studies, that's the general findings, that people that have this low-functioning version of the gene and then are exposed to a traumatic childhood are more at risk for engaging in all kinds of antisocial behaviors.
So what are the implications about how we might be able to help people learn to self-control in the area of aggression?
So with more research, we could start to launch some bigger scale clinical trials looking at improving self-control in those people that lack it. And we can do this in a couple of ways, by practicing self-control like we've done in some of our studies. Maybe one day it could be possible to identify, based on genotyping, children that were at risk, especially if they had the low functioning version and were in an abusive home. We could sort of intervene there. And in fact, if you do intervene with people that have the low functioning allele, but they grew up in a loving family, then they're no longer at risk for behaving aggressively. So eventually we could help that way. Yeah.
Mm. And of course, there are ethical questions, aren't there, that come into play. If we're able to tell what sort of genes particular individuals have, then they might be more likely to commit crimes and therefore be excluded from certain parts of society.
Yeah, that's a big concern. Yeah, I mean, you can see this in the courts probably someday. People will say, oh, I have the gene and that's why I can do it. But in fact, you know, there's many mediating processes when you get from the gene that exerts some sort of influence on the brain. And then you experience that in feelings and thoughts and then to behavior and so on. So there's quite a lot of steps before you actually get to a violent act. But it is interesting to think about in terms of, you know, how responsible are people and that sort of thing for the acts that they commit.
And so what's next for you in terms of your research? Where would you like to take it?
The study that I'm most excited about at the moment is we're getting people to practice self-control, and then we want to see then if that translates into more efficient brain function during this anger control paradigm.
How will you get them to practice?
So what we do in our experiments, there are several ways you can do this. They all share the same sort of features. So what you need is you need to monitor your behavior and override a habitual response. So what we do is we have people use their non-dominant hand for everyday tasks for 2 weeks. If you're right-handed, use your left hand. If you're left-handed, use your right hand. And this is everything from like stirring coffee, opening doors, using the computer mouse. And in fact, it's quite depleting in the short term. But over time, you're building up this resource, this capacity. We know that doing that reduces aggressive behavior, but now we want to see if that actually is helping improve brain functioning and making brain functioning more efficient in these people who are at risk for aggression.
So you're looking at whether you can generalize this practice, exercising this muscle, if you like, to other areas of self-control.
Yeah, no, and we know that does work. There's been quite a few studies on this now, probably a dozen different studies, looking at not aggression, but other areas of self-control. And because the neural circuitry is all the same, we think, underlying all these acts of self-control, that's why it translates to other behaviors.
Tom Denson from the School of Psychology at the University of New South Wales. Roy Baumeister likes to think of willpower as being like a muscle, which can be strengthened through exercise. This is what he and his colleagues have found in their research.
When people perform self-control exercises over a couple of weeks, they do get better, not only at what they're exercising, but we bring them into the laboratory and test them on self-control on things having no resemblance to what they've exercised, but they do better on those too.
Okay, so let's look at what the key tips would be to help us increase our willpower and how we might conserve our energy and use it in the most appropriate ways.
Okay, let me start with the principle that self-control is about changing yourself. It's about overriding one response. So anything you do with that will help anything else. In the first study we had that worked, we had people improve their posture. We told them, for the next 2 weeks, I want you to, whenever you think about it, sit up straight, stand up straight. And that improved their performance on laboratory tests that had nothing to do with posture. So the point wasn't that there's any benefit of posture, although I think there is, but it was just that exercise of watching yourself and exercising self-control to make that change. We looked for things that had no inherent meaning because scientifically it's clear to interpret the results of the studies. So we said if people were right-handed, we had them do things with their left-handed. Some of these exercises meditators do, and a lot of meditation things are very good training in willpower and self-control. You just had to break the habit over and over again that you do everything with your right hand to make yourself do it with your left hand. That overriding, that's what was useful. So the implication is pick something that you want to have an improvement in your life and try to get better at that. Make New Year's resolutions, but don't make a lot of them at the same time because trying to work on several things at once divides up your willpower. And start with the easiest one. Just work on that until you get that right. And not only will then you have the benefit from that and the confidence and so forth, but it will also improve your willpower. Then you can move on to a slightly more difficult challenge.
I wonder what you see as the future research in this area.
Oh, well, there's a great deal that we still need to know. So far, we've looked at the effects of just mild depletion, but there's some interesting findings suggesting if you deplete them more extensively, that produces very different effects. We need to understand more about the brain and physiological processes. A third priority is understanding how we raise people to be better or worse at self-control, that what are the specific things that parents do to produce these good and bad results, and how can we get better results to give our children this great gift that will make them and society better off.
Dr. Roy Baumeister is a Francis Epps Scholar in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University. He's co-author with John Tierney of the book Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength, and it's published by Penguin. For more details, go to the All in the Mind page via the RN homepage, where you can also leave a comment and catch up on episodes you've missed. Thanks to the production team today, Diane Dean and Andrei Shabanov. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and may the strength be with you for 2015. Do join me again next week. Bye for now.